got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken vein.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your host, Cameron English. As always, I'm joined by plant geneticist and professor, Dr. Kevin Folta. And today we're chatting with Dr. Mark Panisi from Oregon Health and Science University, who was involved in a major clinical trial to treat blindness with CRISPR gene editing. Now, this is significant because it's the first time gene editing has been used to alter DNA inside a living human being. So Dr. Panisi is going to tell us a little bit about the disease they're targeting, how the procedure actually works, and what comes next if the trial is successful. So thank you so much for listening. Here we go. All right, Mark, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Pretty good. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. So to start us off, most people probably know what CRISPR gene editing is, but for those who don't, can you just briefly introduce the concept and then explain why this application that you guys were working with, you and your team, why is it so significant compared to the work that's been done with CRISPR already?
Sure. Well, I think it's important that we start in the context of genetic diseases. So I'm an inherited retinal disease specialist, and I see patients who have genetic mutations in genes that are responsible for causing blinding diseases. And in the past, we have performed what we now refer to as gene replacement or gene augmentation therapy. And with that, we're putting in a new normal copy of a gene into a cell to essentially supplement defective genes that are not making the proper protein. So that's something that is essentially additive. With CRISPR, what you're doing is actually going in and editing the native DNA. So you're actually making cuts in the DNA to cut out a piece of DNA. And so in certain situations, you might have a mutation that you can remove such that then a protein that was not able to be made before can now be made.
Okay, that's, you know, I've been watching this from a distance for a while because I'm at University of Florida where Bill Howsworth was for a
while. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, we know a lot about the replacement stuff that was with the adenovirus edition of like RP65 and that kind of thing. But maybe the better way to start is, what is Leber congenital amaurosis? And why was this disorder and this particular allele of the disorder chosen for the target of the therapy?
Right. Yeah. So Leber congenital amaurosis is actually a general term that we use for a group of genetic diseases that are quite severe. So there are probably 25, maybe even a few more genes that can cause Leber congenital amaurosis. And these patients present in a certain way. They often present at a very young age, sometimes even before the age of one. They have very severe vision loss. Some of them are born almost blind. You can sometimes see the eyes kind of roving back and forth because they're unable to fixate on anything. They often don't respond visually to motion, or in some situations, they can be very sensitive to light. And so the RP65 gene, which was the gene for which the first FDA-approved gene therapy was obtained, actually caused a form of Leber congenital amaurosis. But the target of this newer therapy is a gene called CEP290 or CEP290. And so that's another gene that can cause this disease. And it, in fact, is actually maybe even more severe than RP65. So with these patients with mutations in CEP290, maybe half of them are born with light perception vision that they can only really maybe tell the difference between a light and dark room. And the remainder might be less severe affected, but they'll often lose vision by the age of 10 or within the first two decades of life. So it's quite a severe mutation. And so, you know, that's one of the things I think that makes it appealing is that we could make a big difference in vision. You know, another reason that this gene was an important target is that with CEP290, it's actually a rather large gene. So it won't fit into the traditional gene replacement vectors that we have. So really a different approach was needed to treat this.
And that's a good lead into our next question. So tell us a little bit more about the procedure itself, because we talked about it a little bit last time, and what I read about it online was pretty fascinating, but you obviously know much better. So tell us a little bit about what you actually did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, the procedure is really not too different from other forms of gene therapy that we do. There's a standard vitrectomy where you take the gel of the eye out, and then you use a very fine needle to inject fluid underneath the retina, and you create a little blister of fluid, and that fluid contains, you know, billions of these particles that then go and treat the photoreceptors.
Well, you know, you're pulling out parts of the eye, injecting into a retina. What are the risks associated with this kind of treatment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think, you know, with any kind of surgical procedure, you have all of the risks that go along with that. So the standard things that we always, you know, tell patients about, such as an infection or bleeding. Fortunately, those are quite rare. And then because this is a new medication and this is a phase 1/2 trial, you know, there are always unknown risks. So, you know, that's something that we have to be very observant for, because we are dealing with something that is new.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what has the FDA said about this procedure? As you just said, it's very new. So what are regulators saying? Are they supportive or are they skeptical? Mm-hmm. What's the outlook at this point?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in terms of the surgical procedure, this is something that is, you know, very standard and was performed for the RP65 clinical trials for Voretigene Neparvovec. And so that was really the first time I think this kind of technique was presented to the FDA, and they were, you know, favorable towards that because they did approve the drug. You know, one interesting thing about RP65 is that they approved treatment down to the age of 1. And so, you know, part of the reasoning there is that, you know, we don't know how young it's safe to do these surgeries in. And I think there's still a little bit of debate, you know, as to what is the youngest patient you can treat, because the surgical risk might go up as the age goes younger.
Yeah, but with RP65, weren't the first trials in animal models, like there were a species of dog or breed of dog?
Like the Briard, yeah. Correct. So that's where it was developed. Kind of these surgical techniques were developed, you know, first in rodents and then later in the canines. But, you know, ultimately it had to be tried in humans. And, you know, that was the work of the surgeons at UPenn and, you know, also at UCL.
And so how do you know, or when will you know, if it's successful? Mm-hmm. and how do you assess that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's kind of a different question. And, you know, I can't go into the details of the design, you know, of the trial at the moment. But, you know, I think with any phase 1/2 trial, you know, we're always looking at safety. And, you know, we do sort of an array of, you know, functional, you know, measurements to answer, you know, both safety and efficacy questions.
So if things turn out as you anticipate, and I understand you can't really discuss the details, mm-hmm. but if they go as planned, what comes next in the process mm-hmm. of moving right. forward with a treatment like this?
Well, you know, the first step's always a phase 1/2 trial. And if that shows promise, then the FDA is going to probably require a phase 3 trial, which is, you know, usually a larger, you know, trial and what is considered the pivotal trial. So that would most, you know, likely be the next logical step.
Well, are there any other congenital eye disorders which are amenable to this kind of technique?
Yeah, I think there are many, you know, different genes that people are looking at for this technology. So this will definitely not be the last gene that this technology is used on. And I think we will see more candidates in the not too distant future.
One thing we talk a lot about on this podcast and at the Genetic Literacy Project is how the public perceives the use of gene editing. It seems to be more controversial in the food production agricultural space, but has there been any public reaction to the work you've done, or do you anticipate that there will be?
Well, I think that the most of the reaction that I've seen, online, in some of the patient groups has been, mostly praise and hope and certainly a positive response, that we've been able to start using this technology, hopefully to treat diseases that were previously, untreatable. And, I think it really resonates when you have diseases, especially that can affect children and, where we might be able to one day, help improve, the situation of those patients.
Yeah, I agree 1,000%. I think it's such a good example how, especially in disorders in vision, that even an incremental change and being able to shift to be able to see the presence of shadows or being able to see more detail than you have dramatically changes quality of life. And I just think it's so exciting. If people wanted to learn more about this, where would they go or where would they look online?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you can, get a lot of information about, this particular treatment, from the sponsor. Editas and Allergan have websites that talk a lot more, in a lot more detail about the treatments. Also Foundation Fighting Blindness is a great source of information for patients who have rare inherited retinal diseases.
All right. Hey, well, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time. I think this was very insightful.
Great. Well, thank you very much.